Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to this edition of Vatican Weekend. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments I'll be bringing you a reflection by the title of God's Friends and a guided tour of St. Peter's Basilica. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. From February the 12th to the 18th, Pope Francis is set to visit Mexico in the footsteps of two of his predecessors to the See of Peter, St. John Paul II, who travelled there 5 times, and Benedict XVI in 2012. An apostolic journey which marks Pope Francis's 4th journey to Latin America, whose bishops are represented in a body by the title of Episcopal Council of Latin America and the Caribbean, more popularly known as CELAM, whose current president is Cardinal Ruben Salazar Gomez, Archbishop of Bogotá, Colombia. As we know, Francis is the first pontiff from Latin America and during his pontificate has kept in touch with representatives of this body, a body which he worked closely with penning the so-called Aparecida document, naturally before being elected to the See of Peter. I delved into Vatican Radio's sound archives and came up with recordings of the voice of the Pope who founded this body. He's Pius XII. The year was 1955. And Vatican Radio recorded a message which went hurtling over the airwaves to Brazil. But I won't give too much away right now. As in a few moments, you'll also be hearing the voices of Blessed Paul VI, St. John Paul II, and Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus. So, as Pope Francis is about to set off for a 6-day apostolic visit across Mexico, why not glance at these popes and CELAM? It's the 24th of July, 1955. When, from the Vatican's Apostolic Palace, the sound engineers of Vatican Radio are adjusting a microphone, which is about to carry the Pope's voice right across the ocean to a faraway land, where a group of Latin American bishops are gathered together for the very first General Conference of the Bishops of Latin America in the city of Rio de Janeiro, eager to switch on the radio and listen to the words of the Roman Pontiff of the time, Pius XII, to mark this solemn occasion.
Amados filhos, quantos no congresso meditastes os mistérios da divina Eucaristia, pensai que o Redentor e Rei Eucarístico vos consagrou.
Fired, no doubt, by the imagination of his travelling past as Cardinal Pacelli, he enthusiastically captures the mood of the occasion, passionately bringing into the picture Rio's landmark giant statue.
Il statua do Redentor. De braços constantemente abertos em cruz.
A description enhanced by a very literary and elegant Portuguese.
Il spettacolo sovremodo grandioso.
Grandioso, grandiose spectacle, Pius XII declaims, highlighting the figure of Christ the Redeemer with arms outstretched over the people who live as if caught in a tempest at sea.
Mares revoltos de vida.
Caught in a tempest at sea, something this Pope had experienced firsthand during the years of the Second World War. But now, 10 years on, in these latter years of his pontificate, he turns his attention geographically elsewhere. Speaking in days when popes did not yet travel, to the bishops of the Latin American Episcopal Council, which he himself had founded that same year. An event marked by Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus. Years on from 1955. It was in a letter dated 14th of May 2005, addressed to the then president of this body, known as CELAM, Cardinal Francisco Javier Errázuriz Ossa, then Archbishop of Chile's capital, Santiago. I've asked Sean Patrick Lovett to read from the English translation of the text for us. Let's listen.
50 years ago, my venerable predecessor, Pius XII, fulfilling the desire expressed by the General Conference of Latin American Bishops, who met in Rio de Janeiro from the 25th of July to the 4th of August 1955, instituted the Latin American Episcopal Council, Salam, with the purpose of sustaining the pastoral work of the bishops and at the same time of responding to some of the serious problems of the church in Latin America.
Pope Benedict, in fact, quoted, as Sean has just read for us, from the 1955 Apostolic Letter, Ad Ecclesiam Christi, often described as a sort of Magna Carta of this coordinating body which currently has its seat in Colombia's capital, Bogotá, which according to its statute serves as an organism of contact, reflection, collaboration, and indeed service to the bishop conferences of Latin America, all 22 of them. And following in the footsteps of Pius XII, 50 years earlier, Pope Benedict too inevitably focused on the figure of Christ.
Knowing that Jesus Christ is the center of the Catholic faith, and that the purpose of the new evangelization is contributing to ensure that every person encounters the living Christ, Salem has intensely inspired the work of the Latin American Episcopate, so that it testifies to what it means to be faithful disciples of Christ, and nourishes the proper faith through listening to the Word of God.
Words these that also echo those of the first pope to address a General Assembly of the Latin American Episcopal Council in person.
Saludamos y bendicimos a todos los obispos y ordinarios de América Latina.
He was Pope Paul VI, who this time spoke in Spanish, highlighting fidelity to Christ, nourishing the proper faith through listening to the Word of God. But this time offering not only words of encouragement, but words of warning at a spiritual, social, and pastoral level. Speaking out, among other things, against the words of theologians who, he claimed, had lost their way, and against the trend to secularize Christianity. Words he pronounced in Medellin, Colombia. It was 1968, and as I said a moment ago, he did so no longer over the airwaves, but in person as a pilgrim pope, the first in the history of the papacy, as he himself remarked in the Bermuda Islands in the Caribbean, where he stopped over. They're part of this council's nations. Words in English that regrettably were not recorded. Let's listen to Sean again reading from the text.
How strange it would have seemed until recently that the successor of Peter would find sufficient a few hours to cross broad continents and mighty seas and visit distant lands whose very existence was unknown to the first pope. Yet such journeys are but the continuation into this century of the apostolic wanderings of the first, who held the high office of representing Christ for people of all continents and races.
Memorable of these all-new journeys are the images picked up by televisions across the world whose mediatic power had begun to surface even when it came to the Roman pontiff. And in Colombia, too, they picked up on the more visually significant images, like Paul VI's celebrating the marriage of a young Indios couple, his strongly worded speech to the campesinos, which highlighted his preferential option for the poor.
Seguiremos denunciando las injustas desigualdades económicas entre ricos y pobres.
And was accompanied by volleys of clapping and shouts of Viva el Papa. Long before people actually did that sort of thing in the Pope's presence. Like Pius XII, Paul VI too often used metaphors linked to a tempest at sea. His exact words at the Second General Assembly expressed regret that the people of Latin America should be swept by a tidal wave of anxiety, one overwhelmingly characteristic of our day and age. But Pope Paul also had words of encouragement and hope in the Lord. Like yourselves, we too, he said, may be feeling the all-encompassing effects of this tempest at sea, but as the Gospels teach us, we should not fear. Remember, Pope Paul said, how on a night fraught with perils, Jesus called to his disciples at sea and said, "It is me, do not be afraid." But getting back now to our history of Salem, the following two general conferences were attended by Pope John Paul II. And these did not take him to Brazil either. For the third, in 1979, he travelled, only 100 days into his pontificate, to Puebla in Mexico. on the very first of his pastoral journeys abroad. And for the fourth, in 1992, he travelled to Santo Domingo, where he also presided over celebrations to mark 500 years of the arrival of Christianity in Latin America, admitting on that occasion that the missionary church's ties to the Spanish conquest produced both light and shadow for the region's indigenous inhabitants. Eventually, however, it has to be said, Pope John Paul did get to visit Brazil during one of his 18 journeys to Latin America, going to Rio, viewing the statue of Christ with his outstretched arms, and making his way amid the rubble and squalor of the city slums, where deeply moved in a spontaneous and symbolic gesture, he removed the gold ring that Paul VI had given him when he was created cardinal, handing it to the local priest there as a donation to the parish. No doubt, in his heart, he knew Paul VI would certainly have approved. And in this land where Pope John Paul travelled for 12 days on a 9,000-kilometre journey, he too, as Paul VI had done before him, pleaded for social justice. Social justice, which he called for in so many of his pastoral journeys to Latin America, putting his personal stamp on controversial issues of social justice, liberation theology, and church political involvement. But in May 2005, during his visit to Brazil, it was Pope Benedict's turn to meet with this international body, which counts nations where over 550 million people live. In Brazil, like that first time, perhaps not by the statue of Christ overlooking the bay, but many miles away by a river, the Rio Pareba, where a popular Marian shrine by the name of Aparecida is located, and made sure that this meeting too was in the shadow of Christ. Let's listen to the exact words he himself used in that letter to mark Selam's 50th birthday back in May 2005.
Selam will seek to strengthen the spirit of communion, of reciprocal charity, and of the Church's inner life. This unity in charity must shine forth in this very exercise of the apostolate among pastors, between them and consecrated persons in the religious life, and between the very persons who live their inner consecration of the charism proper to their community, all of which makes present the model of our Saviour, who came into the world not to be served, but to serve.
And so it is that, as Roman Pontiff, Pope Francis has met with the members of Selam to discuss a familiar reality on many an occasion, but let's recall how in 2007 it was our present Pope's turn as Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Archbishop of Buenos Aires in Argentina, to attend the 5th General Conference of Selam at this same Marian Shrine of Aparecida in Brazil, a place which has given its name to a much-quoted document, the joint statement of the bishops of Latin America, known in fact as the Aparecida document, which he was among those to present for approval to Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus, a document which called for a rethinking of the Catholic Church's mission in the 21st century. Well, I hope you enjoyed this programme in which I shed light a little bit on the history of Selam. Meanwhile, a change of tone as we join Monsignor Peter Fleetwood of the Liverpool Archdiocese in England for his series, Why Bother? Staying Catholic Despite It All, in a reflection by the title of God's Friends.
If you have ever walked around Rome or any capital city, you will have been approached by people asking you for money. Some are polite, some rude, and some really aggressive or even frightening. If you're dressed as a priest, they are drawn to you like bees to a honeypot. A friend was complaining recently that people were greeting me just because I was dressed as a priest. But that was an easy day. Most days it is a question of being approached several times by people begging. But how do you decide to whom you should give money? Many priests and professional carers tell me I should never give anyone money. But it isn't always practical to take people to a shop and buy what they claim they want the money for, or to take them to a bar and buy them something to eat and drink. And many seem just to want the money. In Rome, there are people who are delivered to the city centre, especially to the places where tourists and pilgrims gather in nice cars. They arrive dressed quite normally and vanish for a few moments. When they reappear, they look like wizened old hags and have developed an apparently uncontrollable tremor in their arms or heads. When it rains, they run off to find shelter. At the end of a day's work, they are picked up again and taken home looking normal again. It must be lucrative, because some of those faces have been in the same places for years. Besides, they cannot possibly have their little territory by accident. That seems to be carefully controlled as well. At the opposite extreme, there are people whose clothes and bodies stink of unmentionable substances, who cannot possibly be there just to make money. They really need help. But is it a good idea to give them money? People who spin fascinating and plausible stories extract various amounts of money from me, and the next time I see them, they're drunk or high on drugs. That is when I really think, why bother? I know we're supposed to give generously from what has been given to us, but is it wise to feed people's weaknesses? But I have to be careful. It is tempting to feel sore that we've been fooled or tricked. If I refuse to give because I'm afraid of looking silly, what kind of reason is that? If I really do worry about how people may spend the money, that may be a good reason not to give them any. But I usually have no idea. Is it worth taking the risk? One person suggested that I should give something to the first person who asked each day. But that excludes needy cases coming along later. On the other hand, I cannot solve everyone's problems, so perhaps I should feel no guilt about that. My instinct is to give people the benefit of the doubt. After all, we could be entertaining angels without knowing it, like Abraham in the book of Genesis. And people who live by the gospel know that they will be judged by God according to how they have treated the weakest and the most needy. Chapter 25 of Matthew's Gospel makes it clear that we should see Jesus Christ in the face of the people we see around us who are in need. My problem is, I don't see Jesus very often. He may be there, but I don't see him. My eyes see professional beggars, or desperate drug or alcohol addicts, or nuisances, and occasionally, just occasionally, people who are obviously desperately in need. I have to learn that it is worth bothering for one very simple reason. They may be people I find it hard to bear, but they could be God's friends. Sometimes, a British gentleman of the streets who has been here in Rome since the 1975 Holy Year tells me very wise things and reveals what a deep spiritual life he has. True enough, at other times he yells and doesn't even know who I am. But he is clearly one of God's friends. Perhaps he's been able to teach me that because we're from the same culture, and I think I understand even the words he doesn't say. If I make a high-minded excuse for not giving money, it may salve my conscience and justify my not giving, but it will help nobody. If I try to see things differently and presume the best, I may be wasting some money, but I won't be refusing one of God's friends.
That was Monsignor Peter Fleetwood of the Liverpool Archdiocese. Finally, as pilgrims make their way to St. Peter's Square during this Jubilee Year of Mercy, I thought I'd like to share with you a guided tour I once took in St. Peter's Square with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Right now we're standing in the centre of the square, Father. One of the reasons this basilica was built over here was because it was obviously over St. Peter's grave.
Here we get into that problem, of course. What they thought was St. Peter's grave, of course, you can take it or leave it. It still hasn't been decided. But you see where the basilica is right now was the Vatican Hill coming down. And the idea was that on the side of this hill was this Roman cemetery. And in the middle of this cemetery, the famous Red Garden Wall. And that St. Peter was buried in the ground there at this red wall in the Roman cemetery, which now is three levels below the present basilica. And so that's how you get the basilica. In fact, if you were to drop a plumb line through the cupola down through the altar, you would come down about 30, 20 feet below the floor today to about a foot and a half square area in the ground where they say St. Peter was buried. So the whole basilica was conceived to cover the burial site of St. Peter. Sometimes. Then it was extended about 15 times over history. And the last, then it was demolished, and in 1506, the cornerstone of the present basilica was put by Julius II. And it took 120 years in 1626.
The location was chosen because it was a graveyard and it was across from the city centre, it was across the Tiber. Countryside in those days.
Oh, yeah, sure. It was countryside until the 1930s, really. Out here, the Prati, this was all countryside here. And so the idea, of course, by Roman law, you couldn't bury people in the city. So this was way outside the city, like the catacombs are outside the city. And this was this burial place out here where pagans and then Christians were buried. And so it's interesting to see what Constantine in the 300s, 326, had to do. He had to remove half of the hill to the north and flip it over and put it to the south to get a flat plain there for the basilica. He had to chop out half of the hill and reverse it to make it flat, just so the cupola or the altar of his basilica would be over this place where the tradition is or was that St. Peter was buried. So that whole thing started there. Some people might come, listen to this, and come someday. You can see that yellow building on the other side of that fence. Well, that's the chapel of the Swiss Guards. That's their little church inside of Vatican City. And there's a little bell tower on top there, and you can hear it every morning and twice on Sunday. The little bell rings, and the Swiss Guards go to Mass there in that little yellow building. And you see also behind the yellow building the beginning of that wall, the famous wall that connects the Vatican Pope's Palace to the fortress down on the river, Castle San Angelo, or Adrian's tomb, where the popes had to run many times when
the
barbarians...
It's like the Pope's escape route.
It's the Pope's escape route, exactly. And you can still see the slits in the wall where the little windows in in the corridor down to Castle San Angelo. See, that's another whole story. And if you just look at that wall, if you just stand here and look at the wall, you can think the last big occasion was May 6th of 1527, when all these Swiss guards were killed in the old St. Peter's Basilica as the Pope Clement VII was running over to Castle San Angelo. And that's why on May 6th, that's why the Swiss guards consider they were founded on May 6th of 1527. And that's their founding day and a big celebration. But that has to do with that wall. It was Clement VII who was running over to Castle San Angelo as his bodyguards, the Swiss mercenary soldiers, were being massacred in the old St. Peter's Basilica. But that you can all see that right from here, you see, in the middle of the square.
Mercenaries, it was common for people in temporal power to have a mercenary army in those days, wasn't it?
They wanted a neutral army, of course, and it was Julius II, really. About 15 years before, who called down these Swiss soldiers as like his private army. And they stayed on, and they've stayed on ever since, as the Pope's private bodyguards. So that's all when you just look at on this side, their chapel and the wall. And then up, for example, there are many things we can talk about for eternity. But you see where those windows are up there. These are the loggias of Bramante and Raphael. Raffaello's Bible series is up there. And the famous courtyard of San Damaso. This is all from 1510, 1575. And you can all see all that stuff standing in the square.
Bronze door, where the Swiss guards actually stand today.
And, that's the official,
and they salute you as you go in.
Yeah, that's the official entrance of the Vatican, the bronze door. And It was put on there by the same man who put the facade on, Paul V. Of course, it's this massive wooden door covered with bronze. And in the old days, that was the way to get in to the papal complex and the papal palace and the second floor and all this other stuff.
And there's a staircase that was designed by Bernini then, eh?
Yes, and it comes out up at the Sistine Chapel. So all of this stuff is all connected.
But actually, heads of states obviously go in by car to the Vatican, by the Arch of the Bells to the left of St. Peter's.
Yes, they circle around the basilica and come out on the second floor in that courtyard that you see surrounded by those windows. They come up on the second floor. But in the old days, the stairway all the way from here up to the Sistine Chapel is so, let's say, moderate or small that horses can negotiate it. And so for centuries, with the entourage and everything else, kings and queens with their horses and parades used to go up to the second floor over the stairway of Bernini.
Actually, not so long ago, this square was home to the various carriages and horses of people who came to visit, of pilgrims, and buses and cars. It used to be a parking spot, St. Peter's Square.
They finally decided this was intolerable. And so they built about four or five different parking lots around the neighborhood here to get out the traffic out, because it was no place for a parking place. I mean, it was just a disgrace.
It wasn't that long ago.
No. Maybe 1975 or 80, right in there, when they decided to cut that. Every once in a while, they do make an exception, and they let people in, because otherwise you just ruin the traffic and the whole situation in the whole neighborhood.
It's amazing how close the Sistine Chapel is to St. Peter's, isn't it?
Yeah. Of course, you have to remember that the Sistine Chapel was there in 1477, you see, to 81. It took 4 years to build it. So 1481, it's finished. Well, of course, the present-day church wasn't even thought of in those days. And all that we see around this wasn't thought of. The oldest part of the Vatican is right there at the Sistine Chapel. That's 1481. There are places there from 1300 where there was like a watchtower next to the old St. Peter's Basilica. So people think, you know, that the church was here in the Sistine Chapel. No, the Sistine Chapel is 200 years before everything else we see around the place.
This is St. Peter's bell. There are a lot of bells. We've been hearing a lot of bells.
It must be 1 o'clock or so. Just 1 o'clock, exactly. And, of course, they ring the big bells on Easter and Christmas and St. Peter's feast day, the 29th of June, Peter and Paul. So these are some of the things that you can just, if you just sit here with a book, especially in this glorious sun, you could just sit here forever and read about these people and learn these things which profoundly affect us. We're still living with all this human work and human personalities.
Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who was for many years and under many popes papal Latinist, is currently teaching Latin in the United States. That brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening, and thank you to all our guests on this program. To find out more about our programming, check out our website at www.radiovaticana.va. And don't forget to like our Facebook page. This is Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.